One of the great ironies of the American experience is that Americans have better lives than 99% of human beings that have ever lived on the face of this planet. And yet we are more discontented with our lives than vast swaths of mankind, past and present. If you think about it, we have actually structured discontentment into our lives. We have intentionally made it our constant companion. First off, we have an entire industry devoted to making us discontented with the marvelous lives that we lead. It's called advertising. The Madison Avenue crowd uses every available means to convince us day in and day out that we do not have what it takes to be happy. We cannot possibly be living life to its fullest without the latest soap powder, without the newest tech gadget, without this new app that I found for my phone. If you listen to the advertising, you will never be happy because there's always a next big thing that you have to figure out how you can afford when that next big thing comes out. And then we actually pay teachers to plant the seeds of discontentment in the hearts of our children. Every school kid learns the mantra, "You can be anything you want to be. You may have a 97 IQ, but you can be a brain surgeon. You're destined to be 5'7", but you can be a star in the NBA. You may be a girl, but if you feel like a boy, you can be a boy." It's a formula for discontentment, for disaster. You know, we measure the health of our economy. There's actually one of the measures of the health of our economy is upward mobility. That's what it's called. Every American parent takes it as their birthright that their children should have it better than they did. Now, I certainly fall into this category. My mother finished eighth grade. That was as high as it went. But she was one of the smartest ladies I knew. My father finished a credential, not a college degree, a credential back in the 1930s at a technical institute. But of his six children, one finished college with a bachelor's degree, three with master's degrees, and two with PhDs. Girards are the American story of upward mobility. But as Americans, we fail to realize how Western and how modern the idea of upward mobility is. In many places on earth for centuries, it was expected that you would live much the same as your parents did. I mean, think about Jesus. He was a carpenter's son, and so he learned to be a carpenter. His parents lived in Nazareth, and so he lived in Nazareth. And it's still like this in many places on earth today. The whole idea of upward mobility is another formula for discontentment. And then I'll mention one final element in this structure of discontentment, and that is the speed with which we get news. And almost all of that news is bad news. We hear more bad news in a week than our forefathers heard in a year. And so it shouldn't be surprising that we are so much more discontented, so much more liable to be unhappy than they were. Now, it's in light of this aspect of the American experience that our text this morning here in 1 Corinthians 7 is just a 2x4 upside the head. So read with me the words of our God in 1 Corinthians 7, beginning in verse 17. Reading in 1 Corinthians 7, beginning in verse 17, the words of our God. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. Or many of the modern versions translate, so let him live. And so I ordain in all the churches. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling, and many of the modern versions use the word condition there, in the same condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it, but if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. Now, if you remember what we've been talking about over the past few weeks here, in our study of 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's words in this paragraph may surprise you. You remember, Christians in the Corinthian church had questions about marriage and divorce. When you got saved, should you have sex anymore, even if you're married? Isn't sex defiling in and of itself, especially if you're married to an unbeliever? So if you're married to an unbeliever, should you get a divorce? If you had children with an unbelieving spouse, wouldn't those children be spiritual half-breeds? If you were single before you were saved, should you get married? It may be that there were Jewish Christians in that Corinthian church who would have strongly recommended that, because that's what the rabbis had taught for centuries, that to remain unmarried was sinful. It was disobedience to the very first commandment of God in Scripture, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And as we know, Paul is attempting to answer all of these questions here in 1 Corinthians 7. But then here, right in the middle of his answer, we find a paragraph, and it seems totally out of place. It doesn't mention marriage. It doesn't mention divorce. It doesn't mention singleness. It doesn't mention sex. But what we need to understand is that in this paragraph, Paul outlines the general principle that ought to guide new believers after their salvation. Ought to guide believers at all times in the lives that we lead. And here, in the space of 8 verses, Paul repeats this general principle 3 times. Now, I got to tell you, if God puts a principle in His Word once, you better pay attention. But if He puts a principle in His Word 3 times, you better memorize it, meditate on it, and live it. So what is this general principle? Well, in verse 17, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk or live. In verse 20, let each one remain in the same calling or condition in which he was called. And then he concludes in verse 24, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. All 3 of those verses use the word called, and the word called in each of those sentences refers to salvation. We're saved only because God calls us to salvation. Without His call, without His intervention, we would all just continue merrily on our way to an eternal hell. But God called us and we responded. We turned to Christ in repentance and faith, and we were saved. So we could paraphrase this principle that's repeated 3 times here. Remain in the state in which you were saved. Remain in the state in which you were saved. Can you repeat that with me? Remain in the state in which you were saved. Now, our approach to this passage is going to be very simple. First of all, we're just going to dive down into this principle that's been repeated three times. And then we're going to look at the two examples that Paul raises to illustrate this general principle, circumcision and slavery. And then we're going to conclude by applying this principle to the subject of the broader context here, this entire chapter, to marriage and singleness. So, to begin with, the general principle of contentment with our circumstances. Now, notice the principle as it's stated at the beginning of verse 17. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk or so let him live. The key word in that sentence is the verb that's translated distributed in our New King James. Now, in many other places in the New Testament, when this word is used, it's translated divided. You remember the man who came to Jesus and asked Jesus to force his brother to divide the inheritance with him? Same word. It's a word that means to divvy up. That's the way we used to say it when we were kids. So, as God has divided to you, as God has divvied up to you, so you are to live. Now, the idea here actually harks back to the Old Testament when the children of Israel entered the promised land. When they entered the promised land, God divided up the land of Canaan, and he gave a portion of the land of Canaan to each of the tribes. And then within the tribes, that portion of land was subdivided among the clans, and then it was subdivided down to the families. And so each family got an allotment. In fact, this is where we got our word lot. You know, when you think of a lot that you build on, you know, a piece of land, the word lot there comes from this idea. It comes from the allotment that was given to a family in the Old Testament. And so the idea here that Paul is trying to say is, the lot in life that you had when you were saved, whatever that lot in life was that you had when you were saved, stay in that lot in life. That's the idea. Now, when we were saved, our spiritual condition, our spiritual circumstances changed in an overwhelming way. We become the children of God. We become the children of the King of Kings. From a spiritual perspective, we become royalty. We become heirs of a great inheritance. All spiritual blessings in heavenly places in Christ Jesus belongs to us. And I could go on and on and on. The calling that Paul talks about in this passage changes everything spiritually. We're new creations. All things have become new. Nothing is the same. But here's the point that Paul's making. Just because everything has changed within us spiritually, that does not mean that anything needs to change in our outward lot of life, our outward circumstances. If I was a plumber before I was saved, there's nothing in my new relationship with Jesus Christ that means that I shouldn't continue to be a plumber. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics has a huge categorized list of every occupation, 22 major categories, and you can take any occupation from that list and you can insert it into the statement that I just made, and it holds true. There should be nothing in my new relationship with Jesus Christ that means that I cannot continue to be, you fill in the blank. Now, of course, if you're a prostitute or a drug dealer or a hitman, well, then being saved will change your job, but those are the exceptions that prove the rule. Any hitmen here? Okay. Now, when you attend Bible college and seminary like I did, you encounter very, very sincere, committed Christians who haven't learned this principle. I can cast my mind back. I can remember sitting in classes with men who had been saved in their 40s and 50s, and their hearts were on fire for Jesus. They loved the Lord. They were committed to following the Lord. And because of that, they had quit a job as a carpenter, as a salesman, and they had come to Bible college, and they had come to seminary. And some of those guys got into those classes and realized very quickly they weren't really cut out for this kind of stuff. They weren't cut out for this kind of study. They weren't cut out for this kind of ministry. And it wasn't very long before many of them were back in the workforce, back working as a carpenter, back working as a salesman. Only now they carried with them the burden of having failed in seminary. How much better would it have been if they had learned this principle before they turned their lives upside down? Stayed where they were and been a faithful Christian, a faithful Sunday school teacher, a faithful deacon, a faithful elder. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me, because God does call some people into ministry late in life. Okay, so don't take what I'm saying to say that all the men that I encountered like that were like that, because some of those men who were in their 40s and 50s sitting with me in class, they completed their education and they went into ministry. But Paul says the general principle here is stay in the condition that you were in when God saved you. Jeannie's daddy used to tell a joke about this. You know, Jeannie's dad was a professor at the seminary at Bob Jones for decades. And he used to talk about a farmer out in his field seeing in the clouds the letters PC. And he said, "The Lord must be telling me I need to preach Christ." And he said, what God was really trying to tell him was, plant corn. Stay in the condition that you're in when God saves you. Now, there are other ways that we fail to grasp and practice this principle of contentment. I mean, how many of us have said things like the following to ourselves? God can't really use me until I graduate. God can't really use me until I get out of this job. God can't really use me until I get this job. God can't really use me until I get married. God can't really use me until the kids are grown up and they leave the house. God can't really use me until I have this much money. God can't really use me until I pay these bills off. God can't really use me until I move. God can't really use me until I'm in such and such a place. God can't really use me until I get past these health problems. God can't really use me until X. It's easy to tie God blessing us and God using us to a certain set of circumstances. And what this passage is teaching is that our relationship to God, God blessing us, God using us, is not tied to any set of external circumstances. We have everything that we need to grow in grace. We have everything that we need to serve God. We have everything we need simply because God called us, because God saved us, because of our relationship with Jesus Christ. And let me take the application one more step. If God has called you, if God has saved you, you have everything that you need to be contented and joyful. I won't use the word happy, because I think that may have the wrong connotation, but it's close to the same thing. You know, the average worldling out there that we meet day in and day out, their happiness depends completely on their external circumstances. And what Paul is trying to teach us in this passage is that that is no longer true of those who have been saved. We have the one thing that it takes to be joyful. We have the one thing that it takes to be contented. Dare I say, we have the one thing that it takes to be happy. We have Jesus. The hymn writer put it this way: I'd rather have Jesus than silver or gold. I'd rather be His than have riches untold. I'd rather have Jesus than houses or lands. I'd rather be led by His nail-pierced hand. Now, why would I rather have Jesus? Because if I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, then I can be contented and I can be happy and I can be joyful no matter how much silver and gold I have or how little silver and gold I have, no matter how much houses and lands I have or how little houses and lands that I have. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, let me offer a clarification, a qualification before we move on. What I have been explaining to you, I have been very careful to call a general principle. This is a general principle. It is not an ironclad mandate with no exceptions, as we're going to see here in a few moments. There's nothing sinful, per se, about buying a new house or taking on a new job or getting married. I don't want you to take this general principle and go overboard with it, okay? I don't want you to take the general principle to an extreme. But having said that, having stated that this is a general principle, on the other hand, it runs counter to the entire direction of our American culture. Doesn't it? It gives us permission, if I can put it this way, to step off the hamster wheel. My daughter Lauren loves to watch YouTube videos of hamsters on wheels, especially when there's more than one hamster on the wheel. Okay, they get it going faster and faster and faster, and one of the hamsters wants to step off the wheel, and when he does, he goes, boing! God gives us permission to step off the hamster wheel without physical injury. We have what we need to be content, to be joyful, to be happy, no matter our external circumstances. So that's the general principle of contentment. Be content to remain in the state in which you were saved. Then beginning in verse 18, Paul outlines two examples of this general principle. The first example Paul raises in verses 18 and 19 is circumcision. Now today we regard circumcision of male babies as a matter of health and hygiene. Some people believe it has health benefits, some don't. I looked it up right now in the United States, slightly more male babies are circumcised than not. But in ancient times, circumcision was purely an ethnic practice. It was a physical mark that identified a man as a Jew. It was the physical mark that divided Jews from Gentiles. And if you look back, especially into the Old Testament era, During that time in the history of the nation of Israel, circumcision would have been a matter of national pride. Jewish men proudly carried this mark and regarded the uncircumcised as Gentile dogs. Just get a concordance or some Bible software and search on the word uncircumcised and read through the verses in the Old Testament where the word is used, and you'll see what I mean. This was a matter of pride. Circumcision was the mark of the chosen people of Jehovah God. But by the New Testament era, not so much. By the time that Paul was writing, things had changed. Israel was now a defeated nation. They hadn't a land of their own. Israel had first been conquered by the Greeks, and at this point, Israel was under the heel of Rome. And in the very Greek city of Corinth, being a Jew would not have been a matter of pride. A Jew sitting with Gentiles in the public baths in Corinth would most likely have endured taunting and mockery because he was circumcised. And so there were Jews who actually took the step of undoing their circumcision. Before I studied this passage this week, I was completely unaware of this. This is what Paul means in verse 18 when he says, "Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised." Archaeologists have actually found a Roman encyclopedia from the first century that explains the surgical procedure in detail that was necessary to undo circumcision. The practice was so common that the Jewish rabbis from this period railed against this practice. And the word here that's translated uncircumcised in verse 18 is the very word that's used in all of this ancient literature to identify a male who had undergone this surgical procedure. So that gives you the background. And Paul is very clear here that when a person is saved, he does not need to abandon his ethnic background. There were probably saved Jews in the Corinthian church who felt like they needed to get rid of their Jewishness. And there may have been Gentile Christians in that church that even encouraged them to take that step. You're not a Jew anymore. You're a Christian now, so you need to make sure everybody knows that. But Paul reiterates in verse 20 what he taught in every church that he planted. Let each one remain in the same condition in which he was called. Were you saved as a circumcised Jewish male? Well, then now remain as a saved, circumcised Jewish male. And I think there was actually a very practical reason for this. Who do you think a saved Jewish male would have the best opportunity to evangelize? It would be other Jews. But if he took the step of becoming uncircumcised, he would be recognized by other Jews as an apostate. It would close the door on any opportunity for him to evangelize. He wouldn't be able to claim anymore that this is what many saved Jews claim today. I'm a Messianic Jew. I found the true Messiah. I'm following the true Messiah. He couldn't claim that anymore. And so from a very practical perspective, Paul says, stay the way you are. You have an opportunity to evangelize. And Paul applied the same principle to the Gentiles. An uncircumcised Gentile who was saved didn't need to be circumcised. And again, remember that many of the Gentiles who were saved early on in the New Testament era had been what we call God-fearers. Many of them had attended the Jewish synagogues. And they had worshipped the God of Israel. But they had stopped short of taking the step of circumcision. They had stopped short of actually becoming Jews. And it's possible that there were saved Jews in the church there at Corinth that now encouraged these God-fearers to go ahead now, be circumcised. Demonstrate that you're willing now to be identified with the people of God. And again, Paul said, you're an uncircumcised Gentile, remain as you are. And Paul's point is that a Christian can be a Christian. A Christian can be happy. A Christian can be joyful. A Christian can be contented as a Russian, as a Ukrainian, as an Arab, as a Jew. No need to abandon your ethnic background. I'll repeat what I said a moment ago. A saved Russian is going to have the best chance of reaching another Russian for Christ. And by the way, are you praying for that? Everybody's praying for Ukrainians to be saved. Are you praying for Russians to be saved? There's a lot of uproar going on in that country. A lot of people that are wondering what in the world is going on. They're in a condition where God can reach them. That's free. That's not part of my message. So why would a newly saved individual abandon his ethnic identity? And Paul added that step was unnecessary because these outward signs have no spiritual value. Paul says in verse 19, circumcision is nothing, uncircumcision is nothing. In our New Testament era, the rituals that God prescribed in the Old Testament law, in the law of Moses, they have no meaning. They have no value with God. God directed the children of Israel to practice certain sacrifices, to hold certain feasts, told them to undergo circumcision, but all of those outward signs and practices pointed to Jesus, the Messiah, and what Jesus would do. And once Jesus came and did his work, these outward practices lost their meaning. And so Paul says at the end of verse 17, what's important to God, what matters to God, is obedience from the heart. What's important is your willingness, my willingness, to bow the knee to Jesus Christ, my King, and obey His commands. And circumcision is not one of His commands. Paul puts it this way in Colossians 2, let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substances of Christ. Paul says, don't let anybody judge you with regard to anything that's in the ceremonial law of Moses. It's nothing. And so don't worry about whether you're circumcised or uncircumcised. Whatever you were when you got saved, remain in that condition. And then in verses 21 and through 23, Paul outlines a second example of applying this general principle of contentment, and this is to slavery. Let me paraphrase the first part of verse 21. Were you saved when you were a slave? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I got to tell you, in this day when many evangelicals are seeking racial reconciliation, we kind of think, what do you mean don't worry about it? We kind of recoil at what Paul's saying here. But before we react, or before we overreact to Paul's words here, we need to learn a little bit about slavery in the New Testament era. Okay? We need to be very careful not to equate slavery in the Greco-Roman period with slavery in the American South pre-Civil War. Estimates are that one-third to one-half of the population of Corinth at this time, at the time when Paul wrote, were slaves. I want you to notice that in verse 21, Paul uses the second person pronoun. He doesn't use it anywhere else here, but he uses it in verse 21. He says, but if you can be made free. Paul knew that there were slaves in Corinth. He was actually directly addressing them with this illustration. Now, many slaves during that period were much better off than the slaves that were kept on American plantations in the pre-Civil War era. Some of those slaves that would have lived in Corinth at that time would have been highly educated. A large percentage of the doctors and teachers and accountants and other professionals of that day were slaves. I mean, that's just counterintuitive to us. Many of them lived in relative ease. They were trusted. They were treated with respect. Some of them had the skills and abilities to rise to high levels of authority in their households. You remember the Old Testament story of Joseph? It's an illustration of what I'm talking about. Some slaves during this period actually preferred to be slaves because of the security. They knew that they would have food to eat. They knew that they would have a roof over their head. They knew that they would have their needs supplied. And if you were a free man who was on the low end of the economic scale, that meant every day going out into the marketplace and trying to find enough work that day so that you could hold body and soul together. And so some preferred slavery. Many slaves during this era were able to buy their way out of slavery because they had skills, as I just said a moment ago, they had skills that they could leverage to make money outside of their service to their masters. In some ways, slaves during this period had much in common with the indentured servants that you and I were taught about in history class from the colonial days of our country. But having said all of that, a slave was still a slave. He was owned body and soul by another. He had no rights. He could be abused. While some masters treated their slaves well, some did not. Some slaves had valuable skills, some did not. And so for some, while slavery would have been relatively easy during this period, for others it was miserable. And it probably was not much better than what slaves encountered in the American South pre-Civil War. So, with that background, let's again consider the words of the Apostle Paul here in verse 21. Were you called while a slave, do not be concerned about it. First of all, I want you to notice what Paul doesn't say. If verse 21 was parallel back with verse 18, what would it say? If you were saved while you were a slave, then you must remain a slave. That's what we would expect Paul to say in verse 21. If verse 21 was parallel to the illustration of circumcision back there in verse 18, that's what Paul would say. He doesn't say that. He just says, don't worry about it. Don't let it concern you. It's not a big deal. And I believe what Paul is trying to say here is, look, even as a slave, you can serve God. Even as a slave, you can be what God wants you to be. Even as a slave, you can evangelize your household. Even as a slave, in that place of great disadvantage, you can be content. You can know joy. I think that's what Paul was trying to say in that phrase, don't be concerned about it. Then notice the rest of verse 21. Paul adds, if you do have an opportunity to gain your freedom, go ahead and grab it. Go ahead and use that opportunity. As I said to you a few moments ago, slaves in the Greco-Roman culture often had this opportunity. And Paul did not try to hold black slaves from using that door out of slavery. This is why I called this principle a general principle, because there are exceptions to to this general principle. And here's one of those exceptions. If you're a slave, you can be contented in that disadvantaged place. But look, if you have an opportunity to be free, take that opportunity. And in just a few minutes here, we'll see why this exception here to this general principle is important in what Paul is trying to illustrate to the Corinthians. Now, some of us, and certainly many evangelicals, would like Paul to sound much more revolutionary in addressing slavery. There are evangelicals out there today who are embarrassed that Paul here does not condemn slavery outright as a vast systemic injustice. That's the word they would use, systemic injustice. But those individuals, like so many today, are insisting that Paul respond to slavery as if he lived in the 21st century. Paul very wisely dealt with the situation that existed in the Roman Empire in the first century. Let me read you a quotation from one of the commentaries I studied this week. I think this is a really good summation. I quote, "Ever the realist, Paul encouraged the slaves, 'Don't let it trouble you.' To have said otherwise would have doomed slaves to crucifixion. Romans were ruthless in their suppression of slave uprisings. A century earlier, Spartacus and his fellow slaves rose up to gain their freedom, but were crucified by the thousands along the Appian Way leading into Rome." Now, we can't take time to dive down into the details, but here's what you need to understand. The principles of equality and brotherhood found in the words of Jesus Christ and in the writings of the Apostle Paul planted the seeds that eventually brought about the end of slavery. Now, we mourn the fact that there were indeed many Christians in the South who tried to defend slavery from Scripture. And those who would destroy Christianity love to hold up those Christians as if all Christians are slaveholders and all Christians condone slavery. And we have to confess. We have to mourn the sin of those Christians. It's part of history. But there's another truth that we need to hold just as firmly. And that is that those who brought about the end of slavery throughout the world were by and large Bible-believing Christians. Listen, the end of slavery didn't happen because of the Enlightenment. The end of slavery happened because hearts were set ablaze by the teachings of the New Testament in the hearts of Christians. And at the cost of great effort and many lives, they finally succeeded in overthrowing slavery in many nations, in the British Empire and in the United States of America, which at that time were that was just huge. And we'll talk more about this in the second service today, but Paul planted the seeds. And today, slavery is a thing of the past in the West, which for many years was Judeo-Christian in its culture. Here's the point that I don't want you to overlook. A person can live at any socioeconomic level from the highest to the lowest and be a good Christian and be blessed of God and be used of God. A person can live at any socioeconomic level from the highest to the lowest and be happy and joyful and contented because they have the one source of blessedness, and that is a relationship with Jesus Christ. We don't ever have to change our circumstances in order to be what God would have us be, or to know blessedness, or to know contentment. We can remain as we are. Now, before we close, we want to take a step back from this paragraph. I realize that I've not covered a couple of verses, and maybe we can get to them in the second service. But we need to step back from this paragraph and apply the truths that we have just learned about this general principle of contentment, and we need to apply them to the larger context of this entire chapter. We need to apply them to marriage and singleness. You know, without coming right out and saying it, Paul expected, I believe, the Corinthian Christians to connect the dots from this general principle to the question that they had asked back in verse 1. It's good for a man not to touch a woman, right, Paul? The question about sex, about singleness, about marriage, about divorce. So let's talk about how this general principle applies to marriage and divorce. Paul's general principle, his general answer to that question is what? What's the general principle? Remain in the condition in which you were saved. So, are you a believer who's married to a believer? Remain in that condition. Are you a believer who's married to an unbeliever? Then remain in that condition. Are you having regular sexual relations? Then remain in that condition. Have you had children with an unbeliever? Then continue to have children. Remain in that condition. Were you single when you were saved? Then remain in that condition. As I mentioned, there were no doubt saved Jews in the congregation, the Corinthian congregation, that may have been insisting that singles had to get married. And Paul says, no, remain in the condition in which you were saved. So that's the general principle. But as we learned with Paul's illustration of slavery, there are also exceptions to this general principle. So let's talk about some of the exceptions. Has your believing spouse continued unrepentant in sexual immorality? Then that's an exception. You may divorce him or her. Has your unbelieving spouse abandoned you and moved for divorce? Then don't contest it. Let that change happen. You're called to peace. Paul says something to singles. We haven't talked about it yet. We'll talk about it next Sunday. You can see it there in verses 8 and 9. Paul states another major exception here. Paul says, if you're single, remain as I am. Remain single. But there is an exception. If you cannot exercise self-control, if you are burning with passion, then go ahead and marry. And I'll have more to say about this in the future. I don't know if I'll get to it next Sunday or not. About Paul's teaching for singleness. So the whole reason for this whole paragraph, the whole reason for Paul emphasizing remain in the condition in which you were called has to do with the subject of this chapter. It has to do with marriage and divorce and remarriage. Paul says, they must have been doing some wacky stuff in the Corinthian church, I'll tell you. I mean, Paul basically was standing, you know, there saying, stop, stop, Remain as you are. Now let me close by asking you to perform a thought experiment. So I want you to fill in the blank. If I only had blank, I could be really happy. If I only had blank, I could be really happy. Or maybe a variation. If I only was blank, I could be really happy. If I only was blank, I could be really happy. I want you to think about that for a few seconds. How would you fill in that blank? If I only had blank, I could be really happy. If I only was blank, I could be really happy. Now let me challenge you. If you found those blanks easy to fill in, you need to check your heart. You see, that's right where many people in our culture are. If I only had blank, I could be happy. I hope what many of you said is, I only had Jesus, I could be happy. That's all we need. That's what Paul's saying here. That's all we need. If we have the relationship with Jesus Christ that we ought to have, that's all we need. And so if you were quick to answer in another way, then I urge you to look to your heart. I urge you to do what the Bible calls repent. You need to change your mind. You need to say, Lord, there's something that needs to happen in my heart, something that needs to change. Godliness with contentment is great gain.